So, I've read to you before from my book, Amongst Alphabet, and also from my poetry books, and I always wish I had something new, but then I consoled myself by saying, well, I haven't read the whole of Amongst Alphabet. And then I tried to think, well, what passages could I read? A lot of you know what Amongst Alphabet is, maybe not everybody though. It's a book I published, it's I think 10 years ago now. But it contains sort of short, provisional, dense little thoughts of mine that I used to write down because I didn't want to lose track of them, but they didn't fit into anything. Mm-hmm. And so I had the idea founded in, as a literary precedent actually, to give each one a title and arrange it in alphabetical order and write an introduction, say you can read this in any order you want. But it's arranged in alphabetical order. I actually know a person who reads the dictionary slowly from A to Z. She's in the K's. But most people don't read the dictionary that way. And I do. I don't think people read Amongst Alphabet that way, though you can read it from start to finish. But there's a list of the title entries, 150 or more. And I hope the title might interest you. And then you read it. And maybe you're often surprised by what's under that word. Anyway, that's Amongst Alphabet. And I was thinking, well, I could make a selection of that fits the retreat. But to be honest, in a sense, I didn't have time or energy because it took me a lot of immediate preparation to get the conferences together time-wise. I was working on, a study I'd done before, but I had to refresh myself. Thank God I wrote that article because I forgot most of what I had once said. So I read it again and then sort of mapped out how much time I could put into an hour. That took me more time than I expected, and I didn't have much time left to think about how to select from Amongst Alphabet. But then I thought, well, just go into a letter. I invite the reader to do that. And I thought, what should I start with? And I said, well, D for Driscoll. And I thought, I could go to the D, R's, the I's, the S, the O. Well, that's too much. So let's do the D's. But before I do that, let me just read the last paragraph of my introduction. The previous paragraphs explain a little bit about the genre of alphabet. And so I didn't invent the idea of an alphabet. But the arrangement, in the end, with this paragraph, I invite the reader to flip around in the book. And that might be a good way for us to come into it tonight. From the edge of America, I am cast into a center of Europe. But wherever I am, I always feel myself guided and provoked by the monastic tradition. I am a monk wherever I am. But if I am a monk, that means also that I am just a man, connected with all other men and women in my time, and in other times. I am searching, like we all do. I struggle to believe, like we all do. Life is lovely, life is hard. This is true for me, like it is for us all. And that is why I think to share my alphabet. Not because monks are different, so worth a visit to see them in a zoo, but because my monastic life has given me the space to think about things that we all care about and all have to face. Life poses huge questions, terrible questions, glorious questions. We must face them. Avoiding them makes us dangerous and makes the world go crazy. What is offered here is provisional. There is nothing normative in what is provisional. In the midst of my going on, I turn at any random moment to any random person who might be interested in joining the search. I turn and I say, oh, think about this. Think about the D's. Density. As I sit quietly in this country place, I think of the adventure of those 2 months. It was primarily a mental adventure, but I know it to be real by the not inconsiderable concrete experience of going to the places that were a part of it. To Paris, to Krakow, to Auschwitz, up the stair to Miwash's apartment, down the streets with Maciej and Gilan. I feel a large store of something within me as a result of having so traveled in mind and body. But I am hard-pressed to say what it is. Yet I want badly to know. There was such density to those days. I need to understand them. I want to do something or make something as a response. But what? And must I? Design. There is a room in a house on the Via San Domenico in Rome where I'm sometimes able to go and write. Like every part of this house, this room has its special genius, a neatly and precisely defined space with its own mood. Where I work, it is uncluttered and filled with a wonderful light that spills in through a tall window on my left. All the details of the house are Danilo Parisio's designs, and every bit of it, handsome and fine. The proportions of everything, they are so learned, clearly fitted by one who knows what he's doing. Out the window, as I turn to rest my eyes and my mind from the work of composing at the computer, I can practice what I read the other day in Miwash's poem called This Only. He spoke of wanting, quote, only one most precious thing, to see purely and simply, end quote. What makes the garden beyond the window such a joy to see from here is the way in which the window frames and holds what I see. It seems an odd thing to utter enthusiastic exclamations about, but I want to keep crying out in appreciation about this window. The proportions, the proportions. The mimosa tree, whose trunk is well beyond my sight, sends its bright yellow branches over for display directly before the window. Whether I turn to it directly or not, its yellow comes silently into my white room. And all through my day of writing, consciously as I turn to look, subconsciously as I turn back again to write, I am tinged within and without by the first colors of the spring. I'm in a great house where, comfortable and warm, I work with all that is outside close in around me. Now the trees' branches are still and the light is waning. During the course of the day, the branches, heavy with their bloom and with the frequent rains, would bounce slowly up and down under the impulse of the soft and occasional winds. I would catch the movement out the corner of my eye and turn toward it, as if in answer to a summons. What a worthy distraction! Or was my work the distraction? In any case, the pleasure and beauty of the scene was enhanced by my seeing it through the noble proportions of the window's frame. The frame, utterly still and firm, strong, tall white lines with their comparatively narrow cross width. And in the open space beyond, the bouncing, heavy-laden branches in their varied movements. Alive, alive, alive. The whole world is alive and moving. Not just me and the tree, but also the house and the room and the window. Also the clouds and the sky behind and above the tree. The roof, the dull red tiles that I spy through the live thicket beyond. We are all alive together and bound into varying constellations by the live number of the proportions through which we see and touch each thing and the next. It was a tribute to architecture, Daniel.
I hadn't read that.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're thinking what would work with the retreat, you don't choose that. So it's good I just went to the D's and we're coming up. We're just coming up with whatever's there. The next one is called Devil. That's a D word too. Nicholas Steinhardt was carted off to prison in Romania in the worst period of the communist regime. His crime? Intelligence, culture, class. In prison, he became a Christian, and after prison, a monk. He has written a remarkable book, full of little and large wisdoms, whose English title would be Diary of Happiness. He says there that the evils of the 20th century are patently clear to any and all. And so it is plainly demonstrated that the devil exists and is near. Consequently, he continues, these times are the most prepared to become Christian. Such claims earn at best a kindly smirk and would be considered naive in comfortable American suburbs and academia. But in the mind of a Central European who has lived through a good part of the 20th century, it is the scoffers who seem naive. What should be patently clear to anyone at all is not clear to these scoffers. Dignity. There is a sense in which we see ourselves from the outside and so make a certain impression on ourselves. we make an impression on ourselves. For this reason, it is very important always to conduct oneself with dignity and grace, even and perhaps especially when alone. It is when we are alone that we probably make the strongest impression on ourselves. If I pull out dignity and grace only when I'm with others, well, how authentic or full can it be? I am always making an impression on myself, and so I ought to be careful. I am always making an impression on myself, and this is the same impression I should make on others. Directions. I am willing to be directed by my faith, and so I pause to get directions straight again. The Bible teaches me that I am made in the image of God, and so why not look to that of which I am an image to understand also myself? Concretely, this means looking at Jesus, the image of the invisible God, and so come to understand myself. And the converse is also true. If I do not look at Jesus, I do not know myself. Dying. I have this intuition about my death and how it will occur. Not its circumstances, but rather the framework in which it might unfold. It would be my entering into that bright darkness of Jesus' own dying. Of Jesus' own dying. In which he experienced an abandonment by the Father, and yet from its depth expressed his own abandonment into the hands of the Father, calling out his name, Father, to the very last. So I hope to die, and I pray, Jesus, grant me this grace. It seems to me that perhaps every death moves in varying proportions between these two poles, the sense of abandonment and the trustful invocation. And for myself, I do not know in which direction I shall be inclined more to lean. In one sense, I feel strongly the desire to let my death be a joyful offering. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. And yet when the time comes, it is difficult to know how it will be. Christ may ask of me some deep sharing in his own sense of being abandoned. And if he does, I must count it a privilege. My heart has been practicing, forced to it by the circumstances of life, by lesser versions of darkness. But even if I am called to a death like his, I will have one thing that I know Jesus did not have. I will have him with me. And I will have the knowledge of resurrection, accomplished and already tasted, as my hope and guide. I would like to think that in my dying I could be a good example to others even a beautiful icon of the Lord himself, as Abbot Bonaventure was to all of us when he died. And yet I may become frightened, scared, unsure, invited so deeply into the mystery of abandonment that my death would be a fearful agony. But I hope that no matter what, it could be said by any who might see me die, altering the words in St. Mark's account just slightly, seeing that he thus breathed his last, they said, "Truly, Jesus is the Son of God." May my seeing that he died thus be like Jesus's seeing that he died thus. Well, that's the end of the D's. And I really was, I was just kind of tired this afternoon, and I thought, I don't have much time to do this. So I did the D's, and I thought, well, D-R-I-S-C-O-L. I knew that would be too many, but I'll just go to the R's. And the first R is a nice one that I wouldn't have otherwise thought to read you. It's called Raisa, which is somebody's name, and you'll hear about her as we go. Raisa. I felt myself cooled by the shade, the trees of green, and the other greens by which I was surrounded. Cedar, fir, oak, fig, mint, blackberry, lawn. It was Sunday afternoon, and I was reading Raisa's journal. Raisa Maritain, wife of Jacques Maritain. And I was reading under the cedar tree, just next to Brother Claude's icon studio. Raisa. There are several pictures of her in the book. One where she has just turned 20. She's beautiful. A bright soul, shining in a young face. And this visual image subtly accompanies my reading, my letting myself be led by her thoughts. Suddenly I hear a loud, clumsy thrashing sound from the grotto below me, to my left, out of sight. I stand up to look and spot a deer, a doe, who in the same instant spots me and so fixes me and herself. I match her stillness and stare. We are two animals suddenly brought together. There is no hostility, though there is caution, more on her part, of course, than from mine. She is the first to move. And when she sees that I don't, she is calmed. Eventually, she climbs to the rim of the grotto, all the while keeping me in sight. In her new position, I see that by moving only my head, I will put a tree trunk between myself and her line of vision. I make my move, and she immediately stretches her neck round the other side of the trunk. I am seen again. I move back. So does she. And so on. Five or six times, I set a slow rhythm, 20 seconds or more, between each shift, absorbing theater. This was a game you don't get to play too often. There was for me an unusual joy in it. But more, I felt simply the deep mystery of another living being. A being for whom eye contact with me was at that moment absolutely vital. She stares at me from a certain distance. The doe, Raisa, being itself. There is distance and a certain caution, but I connect. Here, under the shade of a cedar tree, in the thick summer, record. Everything that is ever done is recorded. I do not know how or where, but what I mean is this: nothing that ever happens can thereafter be undone. It is henceforth a part of things, and its consequences, however great or small, begin to ripple outward and make their effects felt. I'm not referring only to the realm of human actions, and even there to our more decisive and intentional actions. I am referring to everything everywhere, to the spider and the fly, to the tree in the forest, to the deer eating berries somewhere. It is all recorded in the sense that once done, it is what is there and becomes part of what has been. The human mind can note or trace only the smallest fraction of all this. But the divine mind grasps it all, contains it, understands it, loves it, glories in it, records it. This gives me hope when I feel paralyzed into inaction by the immensity of my context and the consequent ineffectiveness of what I would do. No, instead, no matter what I do, if I perform any gesture, however significant or insignificant, it enters thereby into the great what has been and begins to condition the what is now. I perform not so much before other potential observers, myself included, but above all I perform before the divine recorder, who sees all with fond care and will never forget. Well, then there's a whole lot more R's, and then there's I's and S's, but that's almost enough. I just think to finish with a slightly longer one. Are the Barretts here tonight?
No, they had to leave.
Right. Okay, sorry, because the first night I met Gwen, somehow we wound up talking about, you know, how big the universe is. There was a whole conversation around our table. She had one of those new amazing kind of statistics, like there are more planets than there are sands on the whole seashore. And then, oh no, not that. This is like too much. But I've been like thinking of that for a long time now. And one of my entries, I don't want to read it for her, so those of you that know her and Iroh can say that I read this in her honor. This is called Unbearable Sizes. I am asking, and I am troubled in these days, why the whole universe? Why all its beauty and its ageless eons? Is it perhaps material image of divine infinity? being almost infinite, but not quite, being almost eternal, but not quite. The not quite would be the very definition of the difference between all the universe and God, its maker. I feel the tremendous tension of this difference. On the one hand, I feel the "it was good" of Genesis. On the other, I feel the emptiness and futility of all that is made, unless it remain connected in every instant to its divine source. In previous centuries, before the Copernican Revolution and the Enlightenment busted the coordinates and expanded the proportions to virtually unbearable sizes, the Christian mind could contemplate nature, standing in awe mostly of the earth, not suspecting even then how much more of the earth there was to discover for further marveling. The planets and the stars were an innocent backdrop, an ornament to the center, central earth. In such a context, it was wonderful to ponder Christ as brilliant, gracious, almighty artificer. And though the idea seemed extravagant, it was still possible to think that all this had been created for the pleasure of human beings as the more than sufficient context and stage for the human drama. Now in my time, something else intrudes on human consciousness and renders a contemplation like that extremely difficult, if not impossible. I do not have to be a scientist engaged in astronomy to feel all the stars and the impossible distances between them wedging their way into my imagination and causing an old order to crumble. And since distance is eventually time, this new length for time presses into my mind and forces a loss of all former bearings, a rhythm pulsing there that seems to say, from so long ago, you have no idea how long ago. What my project wants to be when confronted with all this internal devastation of my imaginative coordinates is the creation of some new interior space, a space that can contemplate Christ as the Word through whom all this was created and sustained. And then that Word becoming flesh and dwelling among us in these last days on earth, and a Word intimate to me and dwelling in my heart within this universe. This is a lot to hold together. I wonder if it is possible. What would need to happen is new imaginative space. One could postulate that in our times, in this new imaginative possibility, Christ lends a new tone, causes fresh insight to what he originally revealed. This even larger immensity of the universe that stands behind the events of his incarnate earthly life and our own, it is given and exists in this undreamt of size as a new and more accurate measure of the sheer greatness of God and the unfathomable wisdom contained in the divine decision to create beings capable of consciousness and of sharing in the divine energies, to have created us within this vast universe. Unbearable sizes. So Julie, help us get some more music. Because it's a prayer for me.
It is a prayer for you. As I, St. Benedict's sister's name is Scholastica, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And she stands across the church from me.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. When I went into the church on Thursday evening for prayer, I noticed that out of all the warm and lovely lights shining on all the statues in the church, Scholastica got the bright white... bright white, what are the new bulbs called? The LED over the top of her, and it was just like, oh, that's not right. I was so happy the next day somebody changed it.
I've been having a fight with the electrician. The abbot is powerless to change the lights. It took me months to get that
changed.
Are
you serious? Oh, I'm so appreciated. She looks much better in the warm light. Anyway, this little song came out of our realm through the Holy Rule. Are you ready? Okay. This song's about the rule of St. Benedict, loosely stated, as you're soon to see. I've learned just enough to be dangerous, as many of you know, that's so like me. I've learned the anchorizer hermits fight the devil on their own, the Sarabayites lie, and the guiding bags roll. Oh, please pray for Father Adam Jeremy. May he never let a brother mark down. Have you heard about the guy they call the celebrant? I'm thinking he's the guy I want to be. He's got every little thing that you'll ever need, and to every little thing he holds the key. He must be wise and not proud, temperate and mature, a God-fearing man, not an excessive eater. Remember, please pray for Father Abbey Jeremy. May he never let a brother mark down. As we read about the abbot and his qualities, as St. Benedict so stated in his rule, seems a good idea to choose a guy at ease at ease, a monk who's very straight, but kind of cool. If his sheep are profitless and their souls are all a mess, there's only one to blame, and you only get one game. Oh, everybody, please pray for Father Abbot Jeremy. May he never let a brother mark down. We all love the abbot, Father Jeremy. Our friend voted abbot on the hill. He's the one God appointed and was meant to be. He's the one his brothers knew would fit the bill. He's a father filled with love for his flock, young and old. There's nothing like the love of an abbot for his own. Oh, please pray for Father Abbot Jeremy. May he never let a brother mark down.
I said I struggle with them all.
Struggle with them. If it's my opinion, if you can read it and you can write it, you can speak it. But anyway, fascinating to me. No matter what language you speak or wish to speak, when we sing this song together, let's just sing it as it means the most to our own hearts. Okay. Let's see what God can do with that. Espíritu, acompáñanos, los almas a sanar. Nuestra voz a Dios de amor, que es nuestra ansiedad con el dolor. Oh, Espíritu, enséñanos
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. Good night, everybody.